In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
A League Cup final in England, El Gran Derby in Spain, and the start of the 27th season of Major League Soccer. There's plenty for us to talk about on today's pod, but sadly, as geopolitical crisis unfolds in Eastern Europe, we'll begin our show by discussing UEFA and soccer's reaction to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I'm Heath Pierce alongside James Benj and Jonathan Johnson. The Kegelasso Weekend preview begins right now. What is up, everyone? Welcome to the Kegelasso Pod Weekend Preview. I'm joined by none other than Jonathan Johnson and James Benj. James Benj, we'll start with you. We'll just get straight into it. UEFA is going to hold an extraordinary meeting on Friday over Russia-Ukraine conflict and whether to stage the UCL final in St. Petersburg. There's also other implications with regard to national teams and things like that. What are you hearing on your end?
Yeah, I mean, this extraordinary general meeting, which will happen at 4 a.m. Eastern time. So I think by the time a lot of our listeners hear it, it will have happened. So you will know. But the overwhelming expectation, and it should be confirmed tomorrow, is that St. Petersburg will be stripped of the Champions League final. Now, I don't expect that to come with an announcement as to which stadium will replace it. That's a little way down the line. And UEFA, from what I'm hearing, will kind of make that decision based on which teams are in the latter stages of the competition and where would be an appropriate venue to hold it. London at the moment is viewed as quite a strong possibility. There's four stadia there that could host it. And, you know, yes, Wembley and others, as has been said elsewhere, have got other events, other games scheduled that day, but you know those could be moved, I believe, is the expectation for a Champions League final. But the London Stadium as well will be very interested. As you mentioned as well there, you know, there are an awful lot of other things to untangle in this meeting. They will be discussing Russia's upcoming World Cup qualifiers. They're due to play at home to Poland. And if they won that game, they will be playing another home game. I don't see how any of them can go ahead. There's also more international tournaments coming up. Can Russia play in the Nations League? Can the Russian women's team, can they go to Euro 2022 this summer, the women's Euros? That's in England. I don't think so is the answer. You know, and of course, you know, much more specifically, there is Spartak Moscow are still going to be involved in the Europa League, possibly Zenit as well. We're taping this before the final round of qualifying games. And then there's the Gazprom sponsorship, a Russian state-owned energy firm that have been, you know, synonymous with the Champions League. It's the sort of ironic nickname of the Champions League in the UK. People will call it the Gazprom because it's been so synonymous with it for a decade. You know, will that sponsorship be unpicked? I think that there's going to be work done towards getting that sponsorship out of there. A lot of TV broadcasters, I'm sure CBS would be one of them, wouldn't want to be advertising for Gazprom at a time when Russia is undertaking war on Ukraine. So, you know, there's a lot to unpick here. The big headline news, though, is that, the Champions League final will be moved. And I think by the time our listeners hear this, they will probably have heard that being made official.
AJ, are you hearing the same things on your end? Is there anything you want to add contextually to what Benji just said?
Yeah, absolutely. I think James has said it pretty well already, and he's been covering the piece for the website today. You know, obviously just you know, waiting really with bated breath as to what the decision will be. Sort of in the long term, as James said, it's probably unlikely that they'll immediately name a final venue. But you know, there's so many potential complications. I mean, we will see what happens with Zenit when they face Real Betis a couple of hours after we tape this. You know, because that has the potential to make things pretty complicated as well.
Well, listen, let's shift our focus moving forward, unless there's anything else you guys wanted to add on that. Obviously, Jimmy Conrad's not with us today, but we're going to throw up some betting tips along the way if you guys want to jump in on those and kind of give your take on something. I don't have the mathematician capabilities of Jimmy Conrad or whatever website he uses to put a bunch of numbers together to create some odds. But we'll go through some of these things. Let's start with the Carabao Cup final. Chelsea versus Liverpool. Is the Tuchel-Lukaku, James Benge, is the Tuchel-Lukaku relationship irreparable? It seems like it's getting worse and worse and worse, but want to get your take on whether you think that's irreparable, or if we might actually just see him get the start for the weekend and continue to try to see if he works out, considering how much they paid for him.
See, the interpersonal thing, from everything I hear, it's not that much of a problem. And, you know, Lukaku...
So you mean it's more performance-based or system-based?
Yeah, it
just form.
It isn't fitting. And I think that's kind of the real problem, is that, you know, the way that Chelsea want to play, and you saw this especially on Tuesday night when they went back to Tuchel's favoured 3-4-3, it needs whoever that centre forward is to be someone that can drop deep, can kind of flick the ball on, as Havertz did so well for Christian Pulisic. And that's not Romelu Lukaku's game. Lukaku likes to be running at goal with the ball at his feet, and he's devastating doing that. But, you know, you can't play that way if you're a Chelsea striker. The defence will sit deep against you, whoever you're playing. They will challenge you to break them down, and they will say Lukaku's only getting the ball with his back to goal, which is not where he's strongest. So Tuchel wants to make that better. He wants to work out how to fit Lukaku into this team. But I don't know what the easy answer is. I think if you had your first choice wingbacks as well, Reece James and Ben Chilwell, stretching the pitch out wide, that opens up space for Lukaku. But I've hankered after the idea. I'm sure you'll remember this game as well, when Lukaku devastated Nacho Monreal when he was playing for Everton against Arsenal as a sort of right winger. And he did it. He's done it in patches for Man United as well. I'd like to see that. But I don't think that's kind of the long-term solution. So at the moment, I don't really know how they fix it, but I do know that there's a will within Chelsea to try and get this right and not to just give up.
Yeah, this is really interesting to hear, especially given, you know, that I was witness to what happened between Tuchel and PSG, sort of how that relationship between him and the club and the players started and how it degenerated later on. And actually, there's some interesting parallels between Tuchel's behavior with Lukaku and his behavior with Cavani, because again, you know, sort of the personal relationship between the two was always quite good. It's just that Tuchel was basically challenging Cavani to almost fit more into PSG's system. And it's really unfortunate for Cavani that COVID happened when it did in footballing terms, because he was actually just starting to make his way back into PSG's side, could have potentially salvaged him another year or two in the French capital, you know, but it was cut short. And we didn't actually get to see whether Tuchel was almost able to rebuild Cavani, you know, after what had been quite a difficult injury for him to recover from back in the 2018 World Cup. You know, he was never quite the same player after that. Obviously, different ages between the two players, but similar star status within their respective clubs. So, you know, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that Lukaku is sort of forever going to be a face that doesn't fit with Chelsea. I just think it's a question of, you know, giving the power to Tuchel, you know, to sort of sort it out in his own way. That is the way to keep the German onside, if that's what Chelsea want to do.
JJ, with Ziyech taking a knock, Kovacic as well, do you think that increases the odds or changes the dynamic of whether or not you play Lukaku in this? And do you think, who do you have as the favorites in this matchup? Obviously, Liverpool on a tear right now and continuing to close the gap in the league. This is a huge opportunity for a domestic trophy, which they haven't gotten in a long time. But it seems like their focus maybe elsewhere. Obviously, you're in a final, you're going to focus on it, but kind of give me your take on this matchup.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I had to pick a favorite right now, I'd probably have Liverpool just shading it over Chelsea. But then again, Chelsea were obviously thinking ahead to this game when they sent the team out against Lille, because there was no Jorginho either. So I guess you could say that Tuchel was perhaps, you know, keeping Lukaku and Jorginho fresh to come into this game, knowing that he would start with both, you know, but also at the same time, you know, I guess we will see what he takes out of that Lille performance. I don't think that Chelsea really needed to excel at any point. You know, Lille offered a bit of sort of token resistance, but in the end were broken down and the gap in quality was quite evident. But I think it's one thing, you know, Chelsea sort of being relatively comfortable against a Lille side really struggling in the aftermath of their unexpected title success in France, and going up against, you know, sort of the machine that is Liverpool, which Klopp has, you know, sort of purring once again after a very dodgy spell towards the end of last season. So for me, I think that I would slightly favour Liverpool in this one, but, you know, I wouldn't rule Chelsea out, especially when given, you know, sort of what we saw from them under Tuchel last season, especially with the Champions League final. You know, when it's a big match, especially when Tuchel, I mean, Jimmy mentioned this the other day, I think that Tuchel's always in his element when the team that he's coaching is slightly viewed as underdogs. And I think that coming into this one, like I said, many people might just favour Liverpool ahead of Chelsea, and that will really play into his hands.
I think that's Benj, a really strong
I got
point,
a question. Like, yeah, yeah. I was going to follow up on that with you. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. Cheap.
No. It was basically on that, of just that underdog mentality. I mean, this is a guy who's got four trophies in, I don't know, just over a year. But somehow, from the moment they lose their first game, there's always a complaint about their system or the style of play or what's their best 11. But somehow, they continue to figure it out. Obviously, they've fallen back in the leagues so far this year. But do you agree with that sort of underdog mentality is where they're best placed, even if they're winning trophies?
Yeah, I think that's spot on what Jonathan was saying. That Chelsea, it kind of allows them to play a way that better suits the players they have, which is to drop deep, to hold, you know, that five-man defence and then kind of hit on the counter. They are struggling to break teams down, but they are not, like, they're not struggling at all to stop teams getting good opportunities. And it will be harder against Liverpool, as JJ says, than it would be against Lille. But don't forget, Lille kind of got to lots of good positions and couldn't get any further. They couldn't get good shots away at all, not a single good shot in that game. This is the sort of thing Tuchel likes. My concern for Chelsea is down that left flank. No Ben Chilwell. Malang Sarr is not a wing back. Obviously, when he plays, they play in a four. Marcus Alonso is also not a wing back. He just plays there, but he's a winger or a wide target man or whatever, but he can't defend, which we saw in midweek. And it's just Trent Alexander-Arnold and Mohamed Salah he's got to worry about. So that would be my big worry for Chelsea is how on earth they protect their left flank. But if that can survive, then I think Chelsea might just be able to hold Liverpool and nick it at the other end.
Well said. Well, let's move on to the Premier League. We've got a lot to talk about, and obviously, full transparency, we're taping this before the Arsenal versus Wolves matchup. But let's talk, JJ, about Leeds Spurs. Obviously, two managers in crisis. Conte continues to give us the entertainment of Jose Mourinho-esque type of pressers. I know a lot of stuff is getting taken out of context of what entire interviews are, but it certainly seems dire for both these managers in terms of the situation that they're in. Do you think we're in the middle of a crisis at Spurs, or is it just sort of people looking for words to run with right now?
I mean, honestly, from the outside looking in, Spurs never seem very far away from a crisis. Even when things are going reasonably well on the pitch, they always seem to make issues for themselves. You know, it's sort of been a recurring theme over the last couple of years. It doesn't surprise me sort of what's going on with Conte at the moment, but does get a bit repetitive after a while. You know, he knew what he was walking into. And also, I think all of this really is designed at the end of the day. I think I was saying it a couple of days ago on one of the other podcasts that I think this is designed towards him getting what he wants in the summer. In fact, it was when I was chatting with Fabrizio Romano on Monday. I think it's designed towards him getting what he wants in the summer so that he can have a new Spurs, you know, a new look team, you know, a revamped squad ahead of next season. I mean, sure, there's still that stuff left to play for this campaign, and it doesn't help when you're, you know, getting unexpected defeats against the likes of Burnley. But also at the same time, you know, for Conte's methods to really work, you know, for the majority of the squad to buy in, there's going to have to be a lot of turnover. There's going to have to be a lot of those players turfed out. And, you know, with Bielsa, unfortunately, this is part of, part of the charm of Bielsa. You know, you get a fantastic period, you know, period that fans will never forget, where his teams, you know, are willing to die for him on the pitch. And then you get sort of the end, the death throes of it, where the players just can't give anymore. And, you know, I think that that's what we're seeing now. I find the rumours linking Jesse Marsh with the Leeds United post for this summer really interesting. We'll see where that goes. But for me, it doesn't surprise me to see sort of things heading towards what could be quite a bitter end, you know, for Bielsa at least, because, you know, let's not forget what he has done with them. You know, he has brought them back to the Premier League. He has, you know, given English football sort of a new sort of footballing culture to have appreciated. But also at the same time, long term, I don't think that he is the man to sort of push Leeds on any further than he already has. So I think Leeds are probably more in crisis than Spurs.
I really enjoyed JJ doing everything he could to say this happens a lot with Tottenham without using the word Spursy, or without doing that Giorgio Chiellini quote, it is the history of the Tottenham. It's fascinating. You know, I was at the Etihad on Saturday and waiting, you know, talking about press conferences, waiting for Antonio Conte forever just to, you know, end his celebrations. He was nice long interviews for anyone that wanted it. We were going about an hour and a half before he turned up for his pre-match press conference, and he could hardly speak because he'd been screaming so loudly and celebrating. And I think obviously we do have to remember this is a manager that always says he feels every defeat, you know, like a death, or however he phrases it. He is an emotive manager. And I think what he said after Burnley was emotional, not rational. You know, realistically, he knows he's not just going to up and leave after 4 months. But I do think he is trying to play politics here, but he's doing it with all the subtlety of a sledgehammer. It is however many weeks, 3.5 weeks, 4 weeks since the transfer window closed. He has already said to Sky Italia he was not happy with the transfer business that was done. Everyone knew from the minute he was hired that he would want money spent. And he also knew that Tottenham would struggle to do that, especially if he couldn't get them in the Champions League this season, which is really important if Tottenham want to develop a squad that's good enough for Conte. And, you know, right now,
there is some truth to the idea that these players are the same players that every manager has struggled with. Yes, it's a lot on him, but at a certain point, you do start to say these players aren't the ones that work either for the system or for the quality that they expect at Spurs.
Well, but so a lot of the complaints have been about we lost four players, but he let them all go. Yeah. Giovanni Lo Celso was a squad player who he just said, you can go, which is okay. But then he lost Ndombele and he lost Dele Alli. And you watch their games now, you go, because there's no creativity in midfield. I mean, I can see why he's very unhappy that he didn't get a right wing back. But also, you do know this is what happens when you join any club midway through the season. And he said that. So it's hard to sympathize with his frustrations. And I think actually when you look at what Tottenham fans are saying, they're increasingly in that boat of just like, we don't need this all the time. You know, not after every single defeat can we have Antonio Conte threatening to quit. It's not constructive. I'm sure things will get back to a more even keel against Leeds, because Leeds are rubbish at the moment. But
what's your take on this one? Do you think that they can get 3 points out of this? Obviously a Leeds side that's not truly clear of a relegation battle and struggling in themselves. Do you think this is where you see a Spurs bounce back?
Yeah, there's practically no more perfect opponent for Tottenham, except maybe Man City, than Leeds.
Or Villa.
Yeah, that's true. They do love Villa. But, you know, a team that is willing to go one-on-one, that is willing to commit numbers high up the pitch. Spurs did such a good job against City of drawing City up and then hitting it quick to Kane and Son. And they'll do that, and they might well score plenty of goals against Leeds. So I think we might be feeling come Monday morning that the crisis is easing, but it can't ever be one defeat away from the manager saying, I can't do this job anymore. That needs to change. And Spurs need to tell Conte it has to change.
JJ, for this specific matchup?
Just adding one final point to that. I mean, also, is there not an argument that Spurs kind of need to move on from the fact that Pochettino took them to the Champions League final a couple of years ago and sort of constantly comparing everything since then, you know, to that absolute pinnacle of his time in charge? Because I think that's a dangerous game. That's arguably why, you know, we've seen Spurs cycle through so many coaches, Mourinho, Nuno, and now Conte in such a short space of time, because I think that, you know, they almost sort of expect that because they've done it once, they can do it again with sort of minimal changes. Whereas, you know, it was a really impressive feat for Pochettino to actually get them to that Champions League final. You know, so I mean, for me, in terms of matchups coming into this game, I mean, I to be honest, I think Leeds are going to be outgunned pretty much all over the pitch. But, you know, if there is an area where Spurs are sort of questionable, you know, as James was saying, they still don't have that dominant midfield, you know, and Leeds, you know, it has been their strength in the past, but I know that they've sort of, you know, been missing some key figures at times over the course of the season. So, you know, I think that the midfield battle will definitely shape the outcome of this game, but I really can't see anything other than a Spurs win.
Well, let's touch base real quick on the West Ham Wolves game. As I mentioned before, we're recording this before Wolves play against Arsenal. So there are some implications as to how they prep and who they play in this matchup. But this is the battle of the two teams that everyone thinks won't finish in the top four, but are continuing to prove people wrong. James Binge, who do you have in this matchup?
I mean, again, obviously, we're talking about this before Wolves have played Arsenal, but they have been such a tough test for opponents of late that you do kind of have to lean towards them. West Ham are wobbling a little bit. I think the Kurt Zouma affair has knocked them off kilter, and they're very, very reliant on Jared Bowen at the moment. Mikel Antonio is not giving them what he was earlier in the season. Whereas Wolves, it's not always fun to watch, but they're building something solid. They're really hard to break down, really hard to score against. And although they don't get a lot of chances, you know, players.
Hey, they've scored twice in the last two games. They scored twice. It's impressive.
And Pedro Neto, who was phenomenal last season, he should be, he's definitely not going to be fully fit, but he may well be able to play in some capacity. I really like him. I think, yeah, that attack will get better because we saw early in the season when they were all out attack and can't defend at the other end. The large can construct a decent attack. I don't think either of these teams will be seriously in the mix for Champions League football come the end of the season. But I think Wolves will probably keep this momentum going and end the season on a real high. And with the right recruitment next season, and they tend to get their recruitment right, they could be a real force again.
Well, plus 270, JJ, to Wolves. It seems like that they're putting West Ham as the heavy favorites at home in this one, and it just sort of feels a little bit off. Do you think Wolves have the capability to go away from home and get a result? The draw, I think, was plus 235, if I saw that right, plus 270 for a win?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the odds are largely based on, you know, what's gone on in the season as a whole, as opposed to sort of what's been going on lately. I agree with James. I think that West Ham do look a bit ropey. They don't look half as assured as they did sort of in the first half of the season. And Wolves, you know, yes, they are one of those teams that nobody in the Premier League really wants to come up against at the moment. They like make life very difficult for all of their opponents. And, you know, despite the fact that they might not be, you know, a prolific side that bangs in sort of 3, 4, 5 per game, you know, they are a very, very difficult team to break down, you know, and one that can hurt you when you don't make the most of your chances. And West Ham at this moment in time, like James said, Mikel Antonio, not, you know, as nearly as prolific as he has been in the past, you know, and quite overly reliant on one or two players. And, you know, that's quite dangerous, especially when you're going into a match against a side who, you know, are kind of looking like they're going to start rivaling you for, you know, your place in the table. I mean, what, there's 2 points between them before Wolves have that clash later on today. And Wolves have 2 games in hand over West Ham. So, you know, I think this is a game that West Ham can't afford to lose. I don't see them winning it, though.
Wow, well said. Well, Dez, if you want to throw up the rest of the fixtures in the upcoming weekend on the screen, we'll have just some final thoughts from JJ and James Bench. James, is there any other matchups that you're looking at for the weekend that are intriguing to you, or ones that you want to touch on?
The two Manchester teams could have a little fun role to play in the relegation battle. You would think that Everton are going to find it really, really tough to beat Man City. And I'm just looking at teams like Everton as Newcastle start picking up points, as Burnley start picking up points, and they're against Palace. And, you know, those are games where these teams could get dragged. Everton could really get dragged into it. I think they probably are already dragged into it. And maybe the same with Palace. You know, as for Watford, Roy Hodgson has been getting a little bit better, but then bad result against Crystal Palace in midweek. You know, can they turn it into more of a sort of, you know, can they involve themselves in this scrap. At the moment, it feels like Watford and Norwich are gone. But I think maybe if you pick up like sort of 3 points at Old Trafford and take advantage of a team that put in one of the worst performances I've ever seen by a Champions League team in midweek, like Watford should be going there thinking, we can beat this team. We beat them last time out. They looked diabolical against Atletico Madrid. Let's give this a go and see what happens. But that's not really Hodgson's style. He's moaning all the time about Saar and Dennis and Josh King. And I'm like, these are the guys that might keep you in the league. Stop complaining that they're not dropping back enough.
JJ, anything from the weekend you want to mention?
Yeah, I mean, in honor of Luis Miguel Etxegaray, I'd be remiss not to mention our beloved Villa, because for us, I think
James Benj and I both haven't talked about Arsenal at all, yeah, but here we go, good. You know, honor, yeah.
Well, as much as I'd love to bait you and you guys and throw Arsenal into it, I'm going to go with Villa because I feel it's a really, really, important game, this one. You know, Brighton away, not easy. 6 points ahead of Villa in the table. But Villa, if they want to salvage anything from this season, and it's looking increasingly bleak, they really need to win this and move themselves back towards the top half of the table. Because being realistic, Europe's gone. That won't be an ambition until at least next season. But the even more worrying thing is all that kind of positivity that surrounded Steven Gerrard's arrival. Coutinho coming in, Luca Dean coming in. You know, suddenly it's gone. Villa look very, very dry, very stale on the pitch. Again, defensively suspect, which is something that's only really going to be able to sort out, you know, this coming summer. So I think for Villa, this is a huge game against Brighton. And if Brighton get the win, which I'd imagine is more likely than Villa getting a win, you know, Villa are one of those teams that could also be sucked down into that battle late on.
That's well said. And that wraps up our chat on the Premier League. Let's now shift over quickly to Major League Soccer. I don't expect either of you two to be the out and out experts.
Is this going to be a kit ranking?
Oh, I do hope so. I like that pink one. Who did the pink one?
Are
they all done by Adidas still?
Go ahead.
Is it Inter Miami's kit? I do like some of these ML. Oh, Portland. Des is telling me it's Portland's pink kit. Big fan.
Yeah, exactly. That's the Euro style of like, how do we get in the MLS conversation? Well, the kit preview always works. We can rank those. But MLS kicks off 2022 season this weekend. You can check out LME's comprehensive season preview with Max Brados and Paul Tenorio on YouTube and the podcast feed. But real quickly from either of you, based on whatever you know, however much you know, are any of these matchups attractive to you guys? I'll go with LAFC Colorado. For me, LAFC obviously has Steve Cherundolo, a former teammate of mine, is now the manager there at Colorado. A former manager of mine is coaching them. They won the Western Conference last year. I think that's a good matchup. You also saw Kellen Acosta, big national team player, traded over the offseason to LAFC. It'll be interesting to see how he matches up against his former club. Do any of these look attractive to you, JJ?
Well, you guys know that I'm a San Jose Earthquakes ultra myself, so I'm looking forward to that opener against New York Red Bulls. I'm curious to see what happens with Chicago, given the players that they've added. You know, Zichos was an interesting addition before Shaqiri comes in. And really, I'm just wondering, Shaqiri for me is going to go one of two ways. He could have like a Giovinco-esque influence on MLS, or he could just pass through it and be a complete passenger, because didn't really see enough from Leon to suggest that he's going to go and impose himself anywhere anytime soon. I mean, I can understand why Liverpool got rid of him, but for Leon to have moved him on that quickly, suggests that perhaps, he's not as motivated as he could be on the pitch. We know that sort of playing for Switzerland at the World Cup is a major motivation for him, and hopefully that'll be enough to get him to hit the ground running. But for me, Chicago are definitely a team I'll be keeping an eye on this coming season. And that's not just because of the crest or the kit.
Well, back in 2019, I went to Charlotte's Bank of America Stadium for an International Champions Cup preseason game. I think it was Arsenal against Fiorentina. And I was sat there going, well, yeah, there's no way you could have an MLS team here. They'd never fill the thing. But apparently I'm wrong and know absolutely nothing about MLS. Which
very wrong.
And yeah, I'm excited to see what Charlotte FC can do. And is that going to be a record crowd for an MLS game in their home debut?
That is a good question that I don't have the answer to, but there's been some.
Be
I mean, for a home debut, yeah, it could be. I know it took a while for the Benz Stadium to open and things like that. So it depends on how you define that, but it's expected to be a big crowd. And from a youth soccer standpoint, North Carolina is a massive, massive market. So the fan base is big. You have a lot of different communities, you know, a lot of different suburb communities with a huge interest in the sport. So I think that they'll do a good job of pulling in the fan bases from the wider state. Any final thoughts on that, JJ? Sorry, I just hijacked some of what you were saying there. But if not, we're going to go to a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Serie A. We're going to talk La Liga. We're going to talk Bundesliga, Liga. And we're going to wrap this thing up with some final thoughts at the end. We will be right back.
If you're in the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale marketplace where each piece is carefully vetted and verified by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. If you're in the market, use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
All right, everyone, we are back. And guess what? Serie A continues to be on Paramount Plus. We're going to go to Serie A right now, boys. Lazio playing Napoli on Sunday. The Milan teams are in action on Friday due to the upcoming Coppa Italia derby. So let's start with Lazio-Napoli. Lazio are on a little bit of a quiet streak right now, playing this Napoli side who haven't been able to really take advantage of the two Milan teams slipping up over the last couple of weeks. JJ, we'll start with you. Lazio, do you think that they have the ability to get a result here? They're playing at home against Napoli on Sunday. Do you think that they have a capability to, or an ability to use the form that they have to get a result against Napoli?
I mean, I definitely think they have the capability to get the results. It's really just a question of which performance Maurizio Sarri gets out of his players. They've been pretty inconsistent for the majority of the season. You know, they've posted some very impressive results, but they've also had a few shockers as well. The thing that my main observation about this game is that Napoli, they seem to respond. They almost seem to play at the level of their opponents right now. I don't know if that's because of sort of the sort of fluctuating availability of certain key players, notably Osimhen. But you know, they just seem to when they play against somebody who really takes the game to them, and gives them an opportunity to play high octane football, they're capable of doing that. But it's not them who will dictate the tempo. And actually, with the ball, they don't probe. They're not as purposeful as I think that they could be, and I think Spalletti will be quite worried about that. Frustrating as well, because like you said, they've thrown away a couple of opportunities to eat away at that gap at the moment. So I think it really depends on the performance that Lazio put in, because if Lazio sort of throw down the gauntlet to them in sort of the opening 15 to 20 minutes, then I definitely think Napoli will respond to that. But if they don't, I think that this is potentially a dangerous one for Napoli, because they could be lulled into a false sense of security where Lazio's quality tells at any time, and they potentially get the win.
Equally, I do think, building on what JJ said, that potentially a team like Lazio, if they play in the real Sarri fashion, that they're kind of attempting and are not always successful at, but a Sarri team makes the game a bit more stretched, a bit more open. They're willing to commit numbers forward. And for a Napoli team that, as JJ says, are quite reactive, don't like to set the agenda in a game, potentially that could be just what they're after. We saw against Barcelona that Osimhen is great. If you can hit him quickly into the channels, he can attack from there. That would suit them really nicely. And so I think potentially Lazio end up being a good opponent. But we've got to say, I mean, for both these teams, of course, but I think for Napoli, it's going to be a really charged game on Thursday against Barcelona that we won't have seen as we're recording. How much does that weigh them down, whatever the result? Because it's going to be a hard game and it's going to be an emotionally charged game at the Diego Maradona Stadium. I think that's kind of the challenge they have. Whereas, you know, AC Milan and Inter Milan, whichever one there wins that game, both of them are coming into it a bit fresher, a bit less emotionally drained. I think this could be a tough weekend for Napoli. I guess the advantage is that maybe only one of the two teams can really pull away at most. So maybe that's the plus side for Napoli.
Well, let's put some the rest of the fixtures up on the screen. And if anything kind of catches your eye, JJ or James Benge, feel free to jump in on any other matchups coming over the weekend. And as we bring that up right now, obviously got Milan playing against Udinese on Friday. As I mentioned, Inter Milan against Genoa playing away from home. Inter Milan going away from home there. And then you've got the rest of the matchups, Empoli, Juventus, which seems to be a one-sided matchup, but Juventus has obviously not been at their best, at least in the last 7 days or so. Obviously, with the I'm a little skewed with the injury of Weston McKennie. But JJ, is there anything in, from a matchup standpoint over the weekend in Serie A that you're looking at?
Yeah, I agree with you that Empoli Juventus is interesting, especially because they won't know what the outcome of that Lazio Napoli clash is, and it's a chance for Juventus to close the gap a little bit, you know, on the top three. But Empoli have this really weird habit. I remember they were really up and down in my power rankings when I was writing them earlier in the season, because they'd struggle normally against a team sort of in and around their level, maybe even a bit below, but they had this habit of getting really unexpected results, a bit like Spezia, when they'd sort of almost claim scalps as opposed to, you know, sort of like useful points. And I think that, you know, Empoli, especially with sort of Juve, you know, they're obviously going to have to, you know, consider rotating the players a bit so they don't get any more injuries like McKennie's, but also, you know, because they're still fighting on multiple fronts with the Champions League as well. So for me, I think that that's potentially a banana skin, because Empoli could do with a little bit of a boost to take them back into mid-table as well. Whereas Juve, you know, it's already a fairly significant gap between them and the top three, given that Inter have a game in hand over them. And Napoli are already 7 points ahead of them. So I think that's a really sort of low-key important one for Juve coming up.
I should just hop in and correct my total brain fart that I had, where I got confused with our Coppa Italia match between Milan and Inter, and somehow had in my head that they were doing another derby in Serie A. So I should correct that. But also, I'm really looking forward to seeing Sassuolo, fresh from beating Inter in midweek. Always a fun team, a team that punches so far above their weight. James Horncastle wrote excellently about this in The Athletic. But also, you know, that front three, it's a joy to watch when they're in the mood. You know, Scamacca, Berardi, Raspadori. The talent level of young players, and I know that Berardi's not a youngster anymore. It feels like he's been one forever. For a team this small, you know, a tiny little town in Emilia-Romagna, I believe, it's incredible what they achieve, and they always put good football out on the pitch. So them against Fiorentina, that's a really interesting matchup for me, and one under the radar that I'd be keeping an eye on.
Salernitana as well against Bologna is kind of a curious one, given that they're bottom of the table, but they've got two games in hand over a Genoa team that haven't won in the league since they were taken over by American owners. If they can get a result against Bologna, who, you know, have suffered some dubious results over the course of the season, you know, that could potentially be the beginning of, you know, quite the salvation story, given that Salernitana were hours away from going out of existence, you know, on New Year's Eve, and, you know, were saved at the last minute, did a raft of transfer work in January, and now suddenly, you know, have this glimmer of hope that they might actually still stay in Serie A.
That's why I love you boys, because we're getting to that time of year where we can't leave those relegation battles out of the conversation. In fact, they're sometimes more exciting if you don't have a massive title clash to bring up. So I appreciate you guys contextualizing that for everybody else. Now let's do a quick little whip around the rest of Europe. Starting in La Liga, we have the Grand Derby Sevilla taking on Betis and Barcelona against Athletic Bilbao. Is there any, do either of those matchups for you, James Benge, get you excited, or is there something else in La Liga that you've got your eye on for this weekend?
I mean, the Grand Derby is one of the best games in Europe. Maybe not one that our US audience will be familiar with, because Betis and Sevilla, they're powerhouses of Italian. I'm having a complete mare at the moment. Powerhouses of Spanish football. But obviously, you know, the league there is so stratified that you tend not to see them winning La Liga. Maybe Sevilla, they've certainly given competition over the last few years. But two teams that are playing fantastic football, getting results, and will also be drained and exhausted from their Europa League commitments, which always leads to more mistakes, more drama, and that's what you want from derbies. I mean, look at the table right there. You've got Sevilla on 51 points. Betis can reel them in, and I think for them, they'll know that the title is almost certainly beyond them, 11 points off Real Madrid. But I think almost it will mean no less to Betis that they could put an almighty spanner in Sevilla's title challenge by winning away from home in that game. So this game will be fantastic. It's probably, I think, the best game on the continental fixture list this week.
Yeah, I'm glad that James said that about Betis and Sevilla being, you know, sort of two of Spain's biggest clubs, but a lot of people don't really recognize that because obviously they're not winning the titles like your Reals, like your Barcelonas. And there's actually an exclusive with Andrés Guardado of Betis up on the website at the moment, which I wrote ahead of their Europa League clash second leg with Zenit. It's actually a huge week for Betis because they've got that second leg against Zenit, which could put them into the latter stages of the Europa League. But then they've also got the derby at the weekend, which could be huge for, you know, a number of reasons, their own Champions League bid, you know, frustrating Sevilla as well, keeping themselves away from Barcelona, you know, but also next week they've got the Copa del Rey semi-final second leg. And that could be their first shot at silverware since 2004-05. When Joaquin was just coming through as a young, fresh-faced kid. So,
you know, he was 35.
Well, no, I mean, it feels like he's been around forever. And I mean, it's because of him that I bought my Betis shirt, which is about 20 years old, which I've got in the wardrobe in the other room. But, you know, it is a fantastic story. And I urge people to read the Guardado piece because he sort of explains or tries to explain, because he actually just basically tells people that they should come and watch a game at Estadio Benito Villamarín because it's so unique in terms of its atmosphere. And then basically he says, once you've experienced that, you know, whether you intend to go to the game or whether you just happen upon it, you know, you can't help but be affected by the emotion that Betis as a club creates. And, you know, there are a few more passionate cities in Europe about their football than Seville. And, you know, the fact as well that they're looking at a potential final that could be played in Seville, you know, that could land them a bit of silverware. I think that they will be so, so motivated. And Manuel Pellegrini has got a very good crop of players playing some very good football, and they're tying down some of those key players to extended contracts. So they really are building strongly for the future at the moment.
Any final thoughts from the Liga? I feel like that context that you guys gave is really fantastic and helps to contextualize a little bit of the league itself. And also we saw what the table looked like, and outside of these matchups, do you think that this is just one of these one-off years where Sevilla is in the position that they are, Real Betis is challenging, you've got Atletico Madrid and Barcelona, and next year everything sort of writes itself into being a two-horse race or a three teams that you expect at the top of the table, or do you think that this could be a new norm considering that there has been sort of a massive shift in La Liga? I guess that's a lot of big questions to answer, but just curious.
I think in the short term, this style of La Liga where, you know, we should say Real Madrid have been fine, not amazing, but they've done a decent job and they've given themselves a good cushion. But I think in the short term, it's perfectly imaginable that Barcelona end up in the pack, Atletico Madrid end up in the chasing pack. That they're both financially in a really awkward position, and also, you know, they are still trying to understand how their footballing identity works in 2022, and I don't think that will all change this summer. Equally, you know, when you take a step back, there are three teams in Europe whose broadcast rights are comparable to the Premier League, any team in the Premier League, and that's Atletico, that's Real Madrid, and that's Barcelona. Once they tidy up their wage bill, and we kind of still have to assume they might, both of those teams end up with this financial muscle, and especially Barcelona, but even Atletico, they end up with this financial muscle that Sevilla can't match, no matter how good Monchi's transfer businesses are. The same at Betis. It will all write itself back to money winning you points and money winning you leagues, but the next few years are a great opportunity for Sevilla, and you see that in the players they're signing, that they think this might be it. This might be our great chance to go for La Liga. Same for Betis. Same for Villarreal. I think they need a better manager, but that's an aside. But yeah, there's a moment.
that would offend Jimmy Conrad to criticize the manager at Villarreal. But JJ, for you, is do you feel the same thing, or do you feel differently?
No, I mean, I largely agree with James. I do think that your Real, your Barca, your Atleticos, they will right themselves in probably in the next year or two. I'm really curious. I mean, obviously from a PSG perspective, but also from the sort of La Liga landscape perspective as to what happens with Kylian Mbappe this summer, because that's potentially a game changer for Real, for La Liga as well, to sort of have the leading star, arguably the leading star in world football now that Messi and Ronaldo are sort of, you know, almost in terminal decline, really, in terms of their form. If he doesn't go to Real, you know, that leaves a big, big hole both in Real's plans and also La Liga's, you know, judging by Javier Tebas's very public comments. So I'm curious to see how that one plays out. And also, you know, if Barcelona's sort of new money continues to flow in, because if they can continue to build in the way that they've done over the last couple of months, then yeah, you'd expect them to be back in the reckoning, sort of setting the pace next season. With Real, I think it's a bit more complicated than that, because having seen them up close recently against PSG, there's so many aging players in that team who have had better days. And whether you put Mbappe in that squad or not, there's still so much rebuilding to do there. And yeah, I'm sure Real will find, the money to be able to have that rebuild, you know, to pull off that facelift. But also at the same time, they still have to consider, you know, sort of the ways around the salary cap limits and stuff like that. So I think it's more likely that Barca and potentially Atleti, are more competitive as of next season than Real. I think Real actually might drop off a little bit in the short term, depending on what happens this summer.
Well said. Well, let's move on to our some final thoughts. We'll bundle up Bundesliga and Liga. Obviously, we've got on the run of shore, of course, Augsburg, which we continue to expect Ricardo Pepi to score goals. He's not. He's not even in the starting team, versus Dortmund, which we expected our boy Gio Reyna to be back. He's not. He got injured again. We also got Wolfsburg taking on Gladbach, another American derby of players not in form or on the bench. So we can skip over those. But is there any other Bundesliga matchups and or Ligue 1 matchups? We're talking about Lyon-Lille, which I know is a big game for you, JJ, and Strasbourg-Nice. Which one do you want to, or where do you want to go with this?
I mean, there's a lot to be excited about in France at the moment. I mean, obviously, PSG's clash with Saint-Étienne is not, top of anybody's list for this weekend. But, you know, that will bring people's attention to the race for the Champions League. And it's really starting to heat up. You know, you've got Marseille, Nice, Strasbourg all in contention. I mean, it's potentially a huge game, because if Strasbourg can get the 3 points, and we've seen Nice, sort of almost get the more difficult results that are not necessarily expected to, and then lose against some of the more unexpected sides, that would really, sort of cut that gap even further. And the possibility of having Strasbourg anywhere close to the Champions League is extremely exciting. I mean, we were talking about how emotionally charged Betis are as a club and Seville as a city. Strasbourg, honestly, I mean, try and tune in and watch a game at some point if they're the only team on, because watching the atmosphere at the Stade de la Meno is just incredible. This is a stadium that holds sort of mid-20,000 of fans, and I think there's only about 1,500, 2,000 seats in the stadium that are not held by season ticket holders. You know, they really call on that kind of fervent level of support at home, and it really is a fantastic thing to witness week in, week out, especially when you consider how they rebuilt in the last 10 years as well, coming back from the regional leagues all the way up to Ligue 1 and now potentially knocking on the door of the Champions League. So that would be where I'm looking this weekend if I'm a neutral fan.
Well said. I mean, JJ, any final thoughts for you? Yeah, I don't want to force your hand on anything. So what do you want to wrap up this show with?
Yeah, I mean, we all know that the second best league in Europe after England's top league is England's second best league, the Championship, and a nice little game to look forward to for people that are interested in the playoffs and the promotion race. Now, QPR and Blackburn have both got a lot of ground to cover to make it up to Bournemouth, who have an awful lot of games in hand. Blackburn are struggling, but QPR and Blackburn, both great names of English football and Premier League in the 90s in particular, Both have had fallen on really hard times, financial mismanagement, but they're turning it around. Third and fifth in the championship, doing amazing stuff, young English talent. It's a game to watch that, and you might want to start familiarizing yourselves with these teams, because in a few months' time, we'll be looking at the playoff race, and it's going to be good, and we're going to have some great names back in the Premier League once we get rid of Norwich and Watford.
Well said. Well, that is it for us. Thank you so much, James Benz, Jonathan Johnson, and thank you all for watching and or listening. Follow the Kay Golasso podcast on Twitter at Kay Golasso Pod. Subscribe to the Kay Golasso page on YouTube and hit the notification bell. And of course, subscribe to Kay Golasso wherever you get your podcast. And on behalf of myself, James Benz, Jonathan Johnson, our producer, Des Norris, we will see you guys soon.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.